listening to the Mr. Cemetery Show, the podcast that's dedicated to the dark corners of the world. From weird news to historical oddities and the unexplained mysteries, here's your host, Mr. Cemetery.
Hello and welcome back to the show, you sick, twisted freaks. This is the Mr. Cemetery Show, the podcast that's dedicated to all things weird, strange, haunted, and creepy. I'm your host, Mr. Cemetery.
And I'm Krista.
Thanks for joining us here today. We hope you've all had a great week. On today's episode, we talk about a case in 1974 that changed the way many trick-or-treaters and their parents view the holiday, whether they realize it or not. Weird news brings us a cluckin' crazy, hangry story out of Ohio. We also tell you a story about a man who informed his friends that he had been contacted by aliens who invited him through a trip to the galaxy. Those stories and more, this is episode 34, The Pixie Stick Killer.
Okay, let's get to what happened this week in history, but first, I need to go over to the cooler for a cold drink. Refreshing. April 3rd, 1882, America outlaw Jesse James is killed by Robert Ford. April 4th, 1968, U.S. civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated by James Earl Ray. April 5th, 1994, Nirvana's lead singer Kurt Cobain died. April 6, 1772, Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia, ends a tax on men with beards. The tax was enacted by Tsar Peter the Great in 1698.
A sucky week.
April 7th, 1805, Lewis and Clark expedition leaves Fort Mandan on the Missouri River near what is now Washburn, North Dakota, beginning their journey to the Pacific Ocean. April 8, 1766, the first fire escape was patented. Its design consisted of a wicker basket on a pulley and chain. It's a good fire escape.
Yeah. Well.
April 9, 1785, marks the birth of electric car inventor Sebrandus Stratton.
Nailed it.
Yeah. It's really weird to think 1785, they came up with an electric car. And just a quick tip, if you happen to be in Ohio or plan to visit, it is illegal to get a fish drunk. You can drink like a fish, but you can't drink with a fish.
Fucking challenge accepted. Come here, Blinky.
Right?
Still trying to figure out people in a whisker basket.
Wicker basket on a pulley.
Yeah, that would suck.
Uh-huh.
Hey, whatever works.
Then. I guess.
Do you have a haunted, spooky, or just plain weird story you would like to share with us? We'd love to hear about it. Send it to us at themrcemeteryshow@gmail.com, and maybe your story will be on the next episode. But for now, let's turn it over to some weird news. The news that's, well, weird. Woman calls 911 over botched KFC order. Police in Ohio are reminding the public not to call 911 about their fast food disputes, after a woman used the emergency number to complain about her KFC order. The Elusive Police Department received a 911 call from a woman who told dispatchers she did not receive enough chicken at her KFC drive-thru. Quote, "I only got 4 pieces of chicken and I want my chicken," end quote, she told the dispatcher. The dispatcher advised the woman that her problem was a civil matter and that should be discussed with the store's manager, but she insisted on speaking to a police officer at the scene. The department said an officer arrived at the eatery and told the woman there's nothing that he can do about her issue. Elusive Police Chief Scott Meyer said the situation should serve as a reminder to the public not to use 911 for non-emergency issues. All she wanted was her chicken.
Just one chicken.
Just a chicken. She's supposed to get 8-piece. She got a 4-piece. Pissed her off. She hungry. She just wants some food. Yeah. Get in my belly, chicken!
Yeah, but 911's not the use for that.
No.
That's like life and death.
Yeah. It was going to be a life and death situation. She about to kill somebody.
That's true. Woman was hangry.
She was hangry. You know, they put ketchup on something. I want to beat their ass sometimes. When I ask for no ketchup and they put ketchup on it, it pisses me off.
Yeah.
But not getting the food, that would really piss me off. Still, don't call 911. Just smack a motherfucker.
That's how you get 911. You start beating somebody.
Start beating them with the chicken. Don't beat nobody with chicken.
Yeah, no. We do not endorse violence.
I kind of do.
The Mr. Cemetery Show will return after these messages.
Do you like gothic home decor? Then check out Spooky Kooky's Esty Shop. Take a journey into the old haunted library with a book of spell soy wax melt. Or try the Lavender Skull Soy Candle, which is clean burning, ideal for people with allergies or respiratory issues. And there's so much more, from original spooky vinyl stickers to graveyard photography. So check out Spooky Kooky's Esty Shop today. There's a link in the show notes of this episode.
Too scared to sleep? Then get some coffee. Check out our haunting friends over at Sinister Coffee and Creamery. They have the perfect coffee to help you stay awake. Whether you're looking for whole beans, ground, or organic coffee pods, Sinister Coffee and Creamery has you covered. Their beans are prepared in small batches to ensure a gourmet roast that will have you screaming for more. Check them out at sinistercoffeeandcreamery.com and use our special discount code CEMETERY10 to save 10% off your order. Again, that's sinistercoffeeandcreamery.com. Use discount code CEMETERY10 to save 10% off your order.
You know, now's a perfect time to subscribe to the podcast. If we're sitting here listening to these commercials, you're not doing anything else, just go on and subscribe to the show. You know you love us, so what are you waiting for?
Are you into spine-tingling crime stories? Then Krista McKibben's Hatchet Man book is for you. It's a chilling tale set in the 1800s about one of America's earliest serial killers, whose disturbing crimes occurred in both Ohio and Maryland. The book also includes a full trial and confession as told by the Baltimore Sun. Hatchet Man by Krista McKibben is available on paperback and Kindle, only at Amazon.com. Now, back to the Mr. Cemetery Show.
And we're back. We all know the urban legend about Halloween suites that are tainted with pins, glass, razor blades, and even ecstasy. There's one tale of weaponized candy handed out that's based on frightening facts, and it goes a little something like this. Ronald Clark O'Brien and his wife, Danine, and their kids, Timothy and Elizabeth, lived in Deer Park, Texas. Ronald was an optician in Houston and also a deacon at his church. On October 31st, 1974, Ronald took Timothy and Elizabeth out to trick-or-treating. Jim Bates, who was O'Brien's neighbor, joined them along with his son. The kids were running ahead of the parents and were going into every house, even if the lights were off. They were banging on the doors, but many houses weren't giving out candy. A little while later, Ronald caught up with the group with five giant pixie sticks. He said he got them from a house where no one answered the door earlier. He gave the pixie sticks to the kids, their neighbor, and another kid from the church that they seen along the way. As many kids want to do when they get home from trick-or-treating, Timothy wanted to eat some of the candy before bed. His father said it was fine, and Timothy wanted the giant pixie stick, because, you know, that's a lot of freaking sugar.
Mm-hmm. I love those things.
Right? After eating some, he said it tasted bitter. Ronald gave Timothy some Kool-Aid to wash it down with. It didn't help Timothy. He began vomiting and convulsing. Timothy died an hour later when he chose to have the giant pixie stick. He died on the way to the hospital. While doing the autopsy, the examiner stated that there was a scent of almonds coming from the boy's mouth. The autopsy found that the giant pixie stick was laced with potassium cyanide. The police were able to recover all the candy. The last child they had tracked down was unable to open his giant pixie stick because it was stapled shut. The pixie sticks were opened, refilled with potassium powder, and were resealed and stapled. The police tried to get Ronald to retrace his steps and tell him where he got the candy. He said he couldn't remember, and the person who owned the house had the door open just a crack and gave him the candy. He said all he could see was a man's hairy arm. Police were obviously skeptical. The house belonged to a man named Courtney Melvin. He was almost immediately ruled out because he was at work that night. He was an air traffic controller at William P. Hobby Airport, and he wasn't home until 11 p.m. on Halloween. All the police led back to the same person, Ronald. They found out that Ronald was over $100,000 in debt. He was unable to keep a job, his car was about to be repossessed, and their home was going to be foreclosed on. He had taken life insurance policy out on his kids. Ronald had called the insurance company that day about collecting the policy on his son. He also visited a chemical supply store in Houston to buy cyanide. He continued to tell the police he was innocent, even though the evidence was piling up. Ronald was arrested on November 5, 1974, for Timothy murder. He was indicted on one count of capital murder, four counts of attempted murder. He pleaded not guilty. There were many people there, many of Ron's friends and a chemist that Ronald had shown an unusual interest in cyanide, and asked the chemist how much would be fatal for a person. Apparently, the amount of cyanide that was in Timothy's pixie sticks was enough to kill two adults. The amount in the other pixie sticks were enough to kill four adults. Ronald was dubbed the Candy Man during his trial. On June 3rd, 1975, Ronald was found guilty of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder. He was sentenced to death. Ronald's wife filed for divorce and remarried, because, you know, fuck that guy. Her new husband adopted Elizabeth. Apparently, while Ronald was in prison, he didn't get along with the other inmates who hated him for killing a child. He had a bad day. Ronald was executed on March 31st, 1984. Before he was executed, he tried to say one last time that he was innocent. His last words were, "I forgive all, and I do mean all, those who have been involved in my death. God bless you all, and may God's best blessing be yours." Apparently, after he was executed, many people outside started yelling things like "trick or treat" and showering people with candy. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think he's a piece of crap, and he's ruined Halloween for, like, after that.
Oh, it was... Yes.
Especially, you know, you had to start running it through the x-ray machines.
X-rays, I remember that.
And I think they did kind of check through mine, but it was crazy. And then, like, I'm going to say, I think every incident after that, people hear, I don't think there was actual one incident. It all turns out to be hoaxes.
Yeah.
Stuff happening to candy and trick-or-treat.
Yeah.
You hear about it on the news, but then you got to dig later on to find out the person did it to themselves.
Yeah. Every time.
Yeah. It always ends up a hoax.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking all around. I mean, they still do it to this day.
Right. Still now. You still hear it, but then it ends up being they did it. They put stuff in there themselves.
Crazy. Yeah, I feel bad for Timothy. All he wanted to do was go out trick-or-treating, and this scumbag motherfucker just wanted money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kill your own kid because you're broke and sick.
It's fucking crazy. Yeah. He also tried to murder four other innocent freaking kids.
That's true. I didn't realize that. I knew he did it to his own kids. I actually thought he killed both his kids, but it was just the one.
Just one.
But yeah, I didn't realize there were other people's kids involved. Yeah, that's terrible.
He got the neighbor's kid. He got a kid from his church.
Yeah.
Man, what the fuck? Yeah. He deserved what he got.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm glad they hated him in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's crazy. That was my story. What do you got?
My story is about the bizarre disappearance of Granger Taylor. Granger Taylor went missing on the night of November 29, 1980, during a storm in Vancouver Island. A storm so violent that many would call it the storm of the century. Before disappearing, however, he left a note for his parents that read as follows. "Dear Mother and Father, I have gone away to walk aboard an alien spaceship, as recurring dreams assured a 42-month interstellar voyage to explore the vast universe, and then return. I am leaving behind all my possessions to you, as I will no longer require the use of any. Please use the instructions in my will as a guide to help. Love, Granger." On the opposite side of the handwritten letter was a contour map of Waterloo Mountain, which is located some 20 miles west of the Taylor's property. The relationship the map and mountain has with Granger's disappearance is just one of the many enigmas associated with this bizarre case. In the hopes of making a meager attempt at understanding what led to Granger's last night on Earth, then it may be prudent to look into the past of a person whom many call an eccentric yet gifted man. Granger Taylor was born on October 7, 1948. He hailed from Duncan, Vancouver Island, a logging and fishing town, which nestled in the Canadian province of British Columbia, and had what his friends and neighbors hailed as an astonishing aptitude for constructing and repairing all manner of mechanical devices. One of Taylor's oldest friends, Bob Nielsen, even went so far as to say, "I guess you could call him an eccentric genius." Taylor lived on his mother and stepfather's wooded Seminos Lake property until the day he vanished, and despite being an eighth grade dropout, he was considered by all who knew him as a self-taught mechanical prodigy. After leaving school, his list of accomplishments were nothing short of extraordinary. At the young age of 14 years, he built a single-cylinder automobile, which was promptly put on exhibit at the Duncan Forest Museum. And at 17, he managed to rebuild a bulldozer that more seasoned mechanics had long since given up for dead. These already remarkable achievements would, in the long run, be just the tip of the proverbial iceberg. While Taylor was in his early 20s, he found the dilapidated remains of a locomotive steam engine that had been abandoned during the Great Depression and scavenged of its trucks and drive shafts during World War II. A tangle of trees had even grown through its rusted frame. Taylor managed to drag the engine back to his parents' home, and in less than 2 years, with nothing more than his intellect, moxie, tools, freight car trucks, and power transmission components at his disposal, Taylor managed to restore the locomotive to its former glory. In 1973, the province of British Columbia purchased the steam engine and sent it out to tour with a museum train before putting it on display at the BC Forest Discovery Seminar. Eventually, Taylor grew up to be a bear of a man at 6 foot 3 inches and 240 pounds, but his friends would call him Gentle Ben. He consistently remains steadfast in his focus on understanding the nature of propulsion technology, and his next passion would become machines that were capable of flight. Taylor got his pilot license and bought a vintage Kitty Hawk warplane, which he restored. For 2 years, the airplane was displayed outside of a store on the Island Highway until it was sold to a restorer of vintage aircraft from Manitoba in 1981 for $20,000. Taylor's parents, Jim and Grace, put the money in Granger's bank account with the other $10,000 he had left untouched before his inexplicable departure. Always seeking to challenge his mechanical prowess, the now-respected craftsman turned his attention to a new and for many incomprehensible challenge. The seemingly unsolved question on how UFOs could perform the aerial feats that so many eyewitnesses have claimed to seen, and even more importantly, what was it that powered their ostensibly interstellar journeys? During the second half of the 70s, Taylor spent over half a year constructing a life-size replica of a flying saucer in which he equipped with a television, a couch, and a wood-burning stove. He spent a vast amount of hours in his new space obsessing over UFOs and how they were powered. The furnace saucer quickly became his home away from home. He collected all the books he could to understand the machinations of UFOs based solely on eyewitness accounts and the hypothesis of the authors regarding unusual aircraft. About a month before Taylor disappeared, he confided to his friend Nielsen that while spending time inside his saucer, he had come into telepathic contact with an extraterrestrial being who came from beyond the Milky Way. Nielsen would later reveal this disclosure to reporters that, quote, he said it happened when he was in bed. He lay there and got mental communications with somebody from another galaxy. He couldn't see them. I said they can't just be mental, but he said it was like they were talking just to him and to his mind. He was asking questions about the means for powering the crafts. The only thing they would tell him was that it was magnetic. A few days later, a very excited Granger told Nielsen that the voice had returned, and this time the alien had invited him to travel through the solar system. Taylor went on to enthusiastically explain that he wouldn't know until the end of the month where he would be picked up for the trip. However, when the location was revealed to Taylor, he did not mention it to his friends or his family. On the night before Taylor disappeared, the young man entered his stepfather's room and had a long conversation with him. Jim had no idea this would be the last time he would speak to his stepson. Unfortunately, Granger's mother, Grace, was not in Canada to speak to him because she was in Hawaii at the time on vacation. Taylor went on to prepare two wills with detailed instruction as to how his parents should distribute his possessions. Interestingly, the word deceased was scratched out on the wills only to be replaced by the word departed. About 6 p.m. the next day, Taylor walked into Bob's Grill to eat dinner alone. His appearance raised no eyebrows as he was a regular to the curbside diner. The last known person to have seen Granger was a woman who was working in the grill's kitchen that night named Linda Barron. Barron told authorities she saw him come in and have dinner alone, but couldn't remember if anyone tried to have a conversation with him. Barron did remember what the solitary genius was wearing, especially considering that as bright as everyone knew he was clearly not prepared for the oncoming storm. She remembered he wore a brown knitted sweater zipped up front, a black t-shirt he was never without, jeans, and logger boots. He didn't have his winter coat. Strangely, Jim Taylor discovered the coat a couple of days later inside the sturdy doghouse that Granger built for his huge Newfoundland dog, Lady. Barron then testified that Taylor paid his bill and left the restaurant at about 6:30 p.m. in his 1972 Datsun pickup truck, just as the storm was starting to tear through Duncan and the neighboring cities. It would be the last that known human eyes would ever fall on the extraordinary, burly, 32-year-old machinist. That same night, hurricane-force winds were reported in Port Alberni and power lines were downed throughout Duncan and the surrounding areas, swathing the entire region in impenetrable darkness. By dawn the next day, citizens of Duncan were picking up debris left behind by the storm, and they were also picking up a rumor that was swiftly spreading through the town, that Granger Taylor had vanished off the face of the earth. Understandably concerned about his boy's situation, and, more than likely, his mental state, Jim Taylor contacted the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in order to help find his son. Exhaustive checks were made at various places and an analysis of documents and belongings left by Granger, but nothing of his whereabouts or the whereabouts of his truck was discovered. Granger's name was then placed in the National Police Information System. Knowing that it may well hold the key to his disappearance, the Taylors would, throughout the 1980s, occasionally take out newspaper ads offering a $100 reward for anyone finding their son's missing vehicle. They never received any responses. but the truck's registration expired in 1981, convincing many RCMP investigators that it was likely no longer on the road. 6 years after Granger vanished, a logger on Mount Sicker spotted a crater in the ground and metal debris embedded in a tree. Bone fragments were also said to have been found at the scene, and so it seemed as if Taylor had been found, it was said that through the use of dynamite, he had taken his own life. And yet what followed were conflicting reports. While some claimed that the police were able to match the vehicle identification number on the wreckage to Taylor's pickup, others have argued that there was a confusion as to the specifics of the vehicle, with some claiming Taylor drove a bright pink truck and others saying it was pale blue. This may be because it also stated that the truck had been painted pink, therefore the truck may have been registered as blue when matching the numbers. However, it was also said that the truck was painted from brown to pink, not blue. And then there were other reports that threw doubt on whether or not a vehicle was even found, with it being said that the logger actually discovered a crater in the ground and metal debris embedded in a tree. There was no indication that the debris belonged to a vehicle. Even the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who were involved in the search for Taylor and the later discovery of the wreckage, have been unclear as to whether or not bone fragments allegedly found at the site were Taylor's. A newspaper article dating from the time, published by the Montreal Gazette, claimed that two pieces of bone fragment were found at the blast site, and a pathologist confirmed they are human. They were not, however, confirmed as Taylor's, with the RCMP stating that they were working on assumption that they belonged to the missing man. DNA profiling was in its infancy at the time and unavailable to the force on Vancouver Island, and when it did become available, the bones went missing. Some speculate that since Granger had access to dynamite that he used to remove tree stumps and that he blew himself up either purposefully or accidentally while in the mountain. There are also conflicting reports about whether or not Granger used LSD and other substances, which might also explain his UFO's obsession and belief in his telepathic communication with aliens.
Drugs are bad.
Drugs are bad. Others still, however, including Granger Taylor's late mother, Grace, and his friend, Robert Keller, believe Granger Taylor was picked up by extraterrestrials on that stormy November night, just like he said he would be. Perhaps he is still hurtling throughout space in an alien spacecraft, exploring the galaxy, and studying alien astronautics to his heart's content. After all, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, time dilates for objects traveling nearer the speed of light. Perhaps one day, a 35-year-old Granger Taylor will return from his 42-month voyage to find a very different Duncan to the one he left, where phones are cordless, cars drive on their own, and residents still puzzle over the fate of that quirky genius who disappeared on a stormy night so long ago. One more thing. There is a documentary on this case done by the CBC called The Spaceman, but apparently it's unavailable to watch unless you live in Canada. I tried, and it wouldn't let me.
Dang.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think the guy's nuts. I think it's all nuts.
It's all crazy. It's a weird story.
It really is. I don't even know where to begin here.
I actually thought of another possibility.
Yeah?
Okay, the mom's gone in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Maybe the stepfather got rid of him. He's a 32-year-old man, possibly on drugs, obsessing about aliens living at home. Sick of it.
Could be.
I don't know. I just thought, you know, especially back then, that's not a good look back then. But hopefully that the police had done.
Probably not.
Investigate. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe they all investigated. Possibly he was offed, you know, and eliminated everybody from that. But.
Probably not, because they're thinking this guy's just nuts.
Just nuts, and he blew himself up, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
But he's a freaking genius. But he's nuts, which all geniuses are nuts.
Yeah, a lot of geniuses are.
I don't know here.
Yeah.
A fucking wild story, though.
Went off during a storm and never seen again.
I've never heard that one.
No, I accidentally stumbled on this one. I thought it was interesting.
It is very interesting. Mm. Leave us a message over on Instagram and let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd love to hear it.
That's us.
So, that's going to wrap up this episode of the Mr. Cemetery Show. Before we go, I'd like to remind everyone that Ben and Jerry actually has a graveyard where they bury all their discontinued flavors, like wavy gravy, turtle soup, and peanut butter and jelly. Now, I've always wanted peanut butter and jelly ice cream, and I found out that they had it and they killed it. I'm pretty pissed off.
Yeah. That sounds like that one would be pretty
good. That sounds freaking amazing. And they killed it. Bring it back. I want ghost ice cream.
Ooh, Coast ice cream.
Coast ice cream. Do you know what electrician's favorite ice cream flavor is? Chocolate. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, so you don't miss a future episode. Follow us over on Instagram at The Mr. Cemetery Show. Until next time, I'm Mr. Cemetery.
And I'm Krista.
Remember, kids, stay creepy out there. See ya!